This is only a game. I'm Mike Pesca. The sports world once more believes in Tiger Woods. Why wouldn't it? The greatest golfer of the last 40 years, Woods won 14 majors between 1997 and 2008, and his downfall was just as spectacular as his ascent. So spectacular, I only have to say the crash, the injuries, the affairs, and you know the events to which I refer. But last month, Tiger finished sixth at the British Open. This week, he's among the top 50 golfers in the world playing in the WGC Bridgestone Invitational. So is Tiger back? It's hard not to wonder and want.
I want Tiger to succeed. I truly, truly do.
Stephen A. Smith of ESPN, as always, speaking for so many of us. But Tiger's body and age and his competitors might confound the yearning to see the once great golfer sitting atop the leaderboard again. It's a storyline we crave, but what I've been asking myself is, should we? What are the implications of a Tiger Woods comeback? What are we saying when we wish for golf's greatest sensation to once again be sensational, besides a concern for the TV networks?
But I swear to God, just as a sports fan and a golf fan, if he could give us one weekend where the Tiger of old shows up and competes against these young guns, you will see television ratings like you have never seen before in golf.
Armin Katayan, unlike the rest of the world with an opinion and a microphone, has some standing in this matter. He and Jeff Benedict co-authored a biography of Woods, which is the most comprehensive assessment of the man who won the most majors at the youngest age and then was responsible for the most salacious and ceaseless sex scandal the world of sports, nay, celebrity, has ever known. Katayan and Benedict conducted over 400 interviews during 3 years of research and constructed a picture of a genius/monster. Tiger Woods seemed destined to be either history's most perfect golfer or sociopath, and the case could be made that he became both. Benedict says Tiger's father, Earl Woods, all but guaranteed that outcome.
Earl, who's a former soldier from Vietnam, a Green Beret, who's using these tactics that he taught in warfare school on his 14-year-old son, building someone who is more like a machine than a man.
As a toddler, Tiger was seated in his high chair and made to watch Earl practice swinging a golf club again and again. The father believed the thousands of repetitive actions would imprint on the boy's brain.
You can see when he's two that the way he swings a club, that's not natural. That's not normal. He has this regiment that's instilled in him. He has a practice schedule that's like a young pro, but he's a toddler who can't even write his name yet.
It worked. It all worked. Tiger learned the lesson that his parents instilled in him, that you don't just beat, but remorselessly beat down the competition. Tiger was raised to be exactly what he became, domineering, ruthless, ice cold, in sports, but also in life. Which is why Katayan asks,
what's the price of that genius?
Woods destroyed opponents and relationships, says Jeff Benedict.
He has that same cold ability to shut people off just like he would when he's on the golf course. He has that same approach to human relationships that he has to the competitive relationships inside the ropes.
The authors document how Woods broke up with his first love via a letter and hasn't spoken to her since that day, almost 25 years ago. He cut out business mentors and golfing mentors like Marco Mira without a look back. Maybe you remember images of Tiger chumming around with fellow superstar Charles Barkley. But after Tiger's infamous one-car accident, Barkley was mildly critical of his friend. Afterward, Barkley tried to get in touch.
Tried to reach out to Tiger as a friend, just to offer what friends do, sympathy, encouragement, a shoulder to cry on, whatever you needed. He has not talked to Tiger since before November 27, 2009.
So yes, we love a comeback story, but as a narrative, what would a Tiger second act say about exactly the question Katayan raised? What is the price of genius? What if the price winds up being no more than a brief interregnum along a path of overall inhumanity? And what would the lesson be for every parent who ever wanted so badly for a child to excel, or every kid who ever loved a sport but also prized their childhood? I think of Todd Marinovich. Remember him? A first-round pick of the Oakland Raiders who was raised by his domineering father, Marv, to be what Sports Illustrated called a robo-quarterback. A strict diet barred Marinovich from tasting a slice of his birthday cake. He was assigned workout routines that would make an East German Olympian blanch. Here in an ESPN documentary, Marv Marinovich recounts one training method.
I started from birth. When he was in the crib, I'd go through a whole series of stretching exercises. I would, you know, grab the foot and gradually bring it back and stretch the hamstrings. Quads the same way.
But Todd Marinovich flamed out spectacularly. Drugs played a role. Today he admits the drugs were an escape from the relentless pressure. Brutal though that is, it does suggest a sort of rough order to the world. If parents push too hard and their progeny harden themselves, there will be costs. But what if Tiger Woods comes to dominate golf again? Won't that turn the Earl Woods parenting book from a cautionary tale to a viable blueprint?
This is a chemistry experiment that you do not want to repeat in terms of human beings.
There's real cost to it. There's glory. There's hair-raising feats and achievements that this guy has been responsible for that millions of people have watched and been motivated by. But with that has come a tremendous price, and you can't look at one without the other.
But then Benedict talked about all the Tigers faced down over the last decade, his sex addiction, the string of injuries, the reliance on pain pills.
When you see a guy dust himself off after all that and be back in his early 40s, it's great to see him admitting things now like, I'm not what I used to be. I can't do certain things that I used to do. He is, I think, easier to relate to now on a human level than he ever was when he was killing everybody on the golf course.
Stipulated. But doesn't that say more about our humanity than Tiger's? Katayan and Benedict report that Woods seems to have genuinely grown. He's been laid low and for the first time stripped of his invincibility. And he's showing, people close to him say, a bit more awareness and empathy. And maybe that's enough to turn this particular hero's journey into something truly redemptive. Or as golf fans, maybe Tiger's return to form on the golf course is thrill enough. As a job definition, we don't need our entertainers to be more than entertaining. Though it seems, as a culture, we've been rethinking that. If not for our entertainers' sakes, then for ours. It's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're going to talk about Twitter, gambling, and the movie The Sandlot, otherwise known as My Typical Thursday Night. I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thanks, Mike. Thrilled to be here.
And we're thrilled to have you. And by MLB national correspondent Will Leach via Skype. Welcome, Will.
It is an honor as always.
How long have you been MLB national correspondent? That seems impressive.
It just means I don't actually cover one team. That's really all that means.
So I want to start by talking about something MLB related. And it's not an incident. It's a trend. So old tweets by major leaguers are being unsurfaced, often at the most inopportune times. The Milwaukee Brewers reliever Josh Hader had his tweets, and these were the nastiest of the lot. He had them surfaced during the All-Star game. Atlanta Braves pitcher Sean Newcomb wrote multiple tweets in high school that we found out about as he was on the mound facing the Dodgers, Trey Turner of the Nationals, the Yankees' Sonny Gray, a couple other players. None of these players have been suspended. Charlotte, what do you think about, what do you make of this trend?
Oh, man. You know, this is not a trend just related to baseball. Back when I found that a little bit funnier, I wrote this article, like, hire me to delete athletes' old tweets. It's very easy. Like, if agents need to know how to do this, ask me. You do from, colon, your Twitter handle, and then type in every single possible bad word. Just delete those. Trey Turner's teammate, Sean Doolittle, on the Nationals, had this great thread where he was like, you know, it's a total privilege to play in baseball. And if you have these old tweets but you say you've evolved, you have to delete those.
And Charlotte's right, Will. It's not just major league players. Josh Allen, high draft pick of the Bills, he was also involved in similar things. But it is predominantly baseball players, and I wonder if that's just because there are a lot more baseball players in the world, or is because it's the whitest of the sports, especially among American players. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's telling you. To me, the ugliest thing of all of this was even not necessarily the tweets themselves, But the Brewers fans giving Hader a standing ovation when he came out to his first game as if he had overcome some sort of adversity. These guys are still all playing baseball.
These guys literally weren't punished at all,
yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah, that's what I mean. So, like, but the public shaming does matter. Like, frankly, for teenagers now who realize, oh, I should be more careful about saying things like this. And not so much that, like, we're worried about their future career earnings or if they get bad PR, like, they're, like, this is all in Darren Rovell land or something. But, like, legitimately the idea that these are terrible things to have in your mind, let alone to publish. That's the point of the public shaming. And I think that is what I hopefully where we land on.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking something very similar, Will. And shaming is a blunt instrument. But I was looking at Sean Newcomb's timeline. So he used that three-letter anti-gay slur four times in February 2012 and then once in April. And in April of 2012 is when Kobe Bryant spits out that same word in a game. And then the NBA comes and they fine him $100,000. So Kobe, since then, has aggressively called out people for using that slur. He seems genuinely sorry. He seems eager to make amends. These players, when they were teenagers, they didn't have the benefit of someone like Kobe Bryant so publicly saying this is wrong, we need to do better. So I think maybe, like you're suggesting, Will, the next generation can have some superstars modeling correct behaviors, dare I say role models, sports figures who are role models, and I'm a little more hopeful too. Will, what do you have?
Okay, so every NFL season kind of has its signature image, right? Like 1985 has the Super Bowl Shuffle Chicago Bears. But for me, the 2015 season, you think of the FanDuel ads, those FanDuel ads for daily fantasy that basically, because of the venture capital money they had raised, had absolutely taken over the airwaves. Well, if you think that's bad, wait until now. Daily fantasy ads are about to turn into gambling ads. And what's weird is, basically, sports media has been pretending for the last 20 years that gambling actually was legal. The idea that, like, the backup running back's hamstring, you get the updates right before the game, are not for, like, people that are really, really worried about that running back. They're for gamblers. And so once you now make gambling legal, I think it very much invites a lot of junk to be on our airways.
See, I just thought they were for hamstring enthusiasts, of which I am one. Charlotte, do you have a similar fear of the deluge of gambling ads?
Honestly, no. You know, exactly, Will, what you say is, you know, sports media has been pretending this is legal forever. I think that especially the nature of sports programming is so 24/7 that I don't see a segment on gambling replacing a necessary segment on something else that might have been better. Like, I think that you're still trying to fill space, and like, I don't see that being more annoying than like whatever else they would have put to fill the airwaves. I feel like we're so far down the gambling rabbit hole with sports anyway that making it legal is sort of like, okay, cool, now I guess you don't have to hide it. I don't think it's going to be too much of a difference, to be honest.
I have to say, Charlotte, I have to disagree, because this could take away from Matt Hasselbeck and Charles Woodson laughing at Rex Ryan's jokes on the NFL Sunday Countdown. And
that's
we
what I mean, you know, like, do you want more Rex, or do you want like slightly less Rex and a little bit more like, hey, here are the odds?
I think you're right, Charlotte. I think that if these ads take the discussion of who's the elite QB and replace it with who's the elite three-team parlay, it's not that huge a loss. But Will, I think this is what I think is going on. I think there used to be at least a within the world of sports, this cool sheen of being the gambler. And this is why when Brent Musburger would ever mention a point spread, it was celebrated as this cool thing because it had this frisson of danger. And it was exactly like the analogy I would make is to pot jokes. And when pot was illegal, it was cool and you could get any cheap laugh by making any pot joke. And now I think that marijuana is getting legal. I yearn for the day when that cheap laugh is at least earned, and maybe something like that will go on with sports gambling.
What televised poker did, right? Suddenly made it like cool until something very, very, very uncool.
Yup. Excellent analogy. Charlotte, I understand you're a bit of a cinephile. Is this correct?
Yeah. Real big into the talkies. I am somewhat of a cinephile, mostly for 90s sports movies that people get very nostalgic for these days. I recently, I forget how I ended up here, but I was on the Brooklyn Cyclones website. They're a minor league team in Coney Island, and I saw that on a upcoming Saturday night in July was the Great Hambino Night. You know, I love the movie The Sandlot, which, you know, the Great Hambino, Ham Porter, is a character in that. And so I clicked it, and it was like Patrick Renna, who's the actor who played Ham Porter, will be at the ballpark. And I lost my mind.
They landed Patrick Renna?
Yeah, I was like, oh, damn, this guy's so cool. And I met him, and I saw him be incredibly generous and gracious with the fans, some of whom had waited 2 hours to meet him. It was very moving to see how much the people who showed up for him, you know, how much they love him and how much this movie still means to them.
The weird thing about him is it's probably one of the main reasons he's able to connect so much with his fans is that he looks exactly like he did in that movie. He's not even that much taller than he was during that movie.
He walked in and I was like, wow, you really haven't grown.
Well, I hope he didn't say that.
I didn't. Sorry, Patrick. He was lovely. I loved him, but he is short.
I was looking through the cast of The Sandlot, and I don't know if this has happened before, but the guy who played Babe Ruth, Art LaFleur, what an acting career, and includes having played one of the members of the 1919 Black Sox in Field of Dreams.
Whoa, a real baseball guy.
Andy was in Cobra.
Well, thank you, guys. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thanks, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And Major League Baseball's national correspondent, Will Leach. Will, you're bad. You're nationwide. Thank you so much.
Please. It's Dr. National Correspondent.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mike Pesca. Greg Metcalf coached distance runners at the University of Washington for more than 15 years. He brought sporting glory to the team, which won its first national cross-country championship in 2008, when he was also National Coach of the Year. But over the past few years, athletes have started talking about Metcalf's darker side. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has the story.
The first time he saw Greg Metcalf, Jake Schmidt was a freshman at the University of California in Berkeley. He was racing at what were then the Pac-10 cross-country championships.
I was having a particularly bad race. I was feeling pretty bad about myself. I was towards the back of the pack, which is not a great place to be.
It was also a bad day for some of the University of Washington runners. Jake says he was running with five of them when the group passed Greg Metcalf, the UW coach.
And this man was going absolutely crazy. He was so excited, totally coaching, cheering, screaming, yelling, and I could not believe the energy coming from this human being. And I just thought, that's who I want to run for.
So, in 2007, Jake transferred to the University of Washington to race for Greg Metcalf. I heard about Metcalf's energy over and over again from every former UW runner I talked to.
I mean, literally, the guy gets so excited, he elevates off the ground.
That's Megan Lyle. During her first 3 years at the UW, she ran recreationally.
I really didn't have anything in terms of a running resume.
But at the end of her junior year, she sent Metcalf an email.
Like, literally, I reached out and said, gosh, I did this treadmill run and it was pretty fast. Maybe I could try out for the team.
Megan says Metcalf gave her some training to do over the summer. And that fall, she walked onto the team.
My first cross-country race, I borrowed shoes.
Against all odds, at cross-country nationals that year, Megan was the third fastest runner on the UW team.
It was crazy that Metcalf believed in me. I still thank him for that because I don't think that I did. So I needed somebody else to.
People can do amazing things when they know that someone believes in them.
Lindsay Kirschman arrived at the UW in 2006.
And I remember reading his kind of like spiel on all of the incoming freshmen. He wrote, Lindsay Kirschman is one of the fastest women in America, bar none. And I still remember that today because it just gave me such a huge burst of confidence.
Lindsay says she didn't run as well as she would have liked in college, but she did everything she could to contribute to the team and to please Coach Metcalf.
Coach Metcalf was like our boss and our coach, someone we wanted to respect, And we really wanted to please him.
But Lindsay says over time, she stopped trusting him.
The person that you meet face to face is not the real person. What he says to your face is not what he says behind your back. And you know that if he's making comments about other athletes that are your teammates, then surely he's making comments about you too. My best friend in college, she told me later that he used to call me a fat lesbian behind my back. I was engaged to a man, and I don't think you should use the term lesbian in a negative way regardless.
Lindsay says she struggled with undiagnosed anorexia all through high school, and when she heard about Metcalf's comment...
That was so devastating to feel that crushing blow of two words, right? Fat lesbian. And it's just like, wow, I gave my soul to you, and that's what you think of me.
The first time I heard this story, it was from Lindsay's best friend, the one who heard Metcalf use those words. Lindsay says the comment still affects her.
That confidence that you had just... It doesn't just go away. It's like you get negative confidence. Well, shoot, like, I thought he believed in me, but apparently not. So now I have to struggle and figure out how to believe in myself.
I spoke with 8 former UW athletes for this story, and most of them mentioned times when Metcalf fat-shamed runners. Lindsay's teammate, Amy Leah, remembers a time she overheard Metcalf targeting one of the team's runners during what was supposed to be a men's only meeting.
You know, like, things like, you're a fat piece of shit. I just remember it being like a public shaming about his weight.
Amy says Metcalf often got angry and singled people out during team meetings.
He definitely has a light switch that he just flips on and off, and you don't know which one you're going to get each day. You were always kind of like, I hope it's good Metcalf today.
But yeah, meetings were always a really scary thing.
Katie Knight just graduated from the University of Washington this spring.
The whole entire group is just like nervous. And that was something that really built on itself as far as like why I would feel so anxious around him.
In high school, Katie was one of the top distance runners in the state. 4 universities, including the UW and Stanford, offered her full ride scholarships. She chose the UW because it seemed to her that Metcalf would support both her athletic and her academic goals. Katie had experienced anxiety before, but she says as her collegiate career progressed, she started getting more and more anxious about running.
I was having a really hard time, like, just doing training runs and having, like, panic attacks during runs and just really struggling.
Over winter break, her 4th year of college, Katie was trying to get her panic attacks under control. She stopped filling out the training logs Metcalf provided and instead kept track of her running on Google Docs. When she came back from break, she met with Metcalf and the assistant coach.
I was sitting there and he just starts like yelling at me. Like he's like, I don't know why you have to do your own special log. Like what the f*** is wrong with you? And like, it like makes my heart go fast. Like even just thinking about it. And I just started like having a full on panic attack in this meeting. Just like I couldn't breathe and I couldn't think. And he's just still like talking at me. And I just, like, got to the point where I was like, I need him to stop. I can't. Like, I need him to stop. Just was like, please stop. Please stop talking. And he just, like, looked at me with this look of just, like, disgust. Like, what's wrong with you? I just, like, never was able to recover from that because how could I ever trust him again, right?
Because of her anxiety, Katie medically retired from the team in May 2017, after being one of the fastest runners in the state in high school. Today, she doesn't run at all.
I definitely feel really sad that a sport that I loved feels like it was taken away from me. I can't go for runs and be happy doing it. And it used to bring me a lot of joy, and it used to make me feel proud of who I was and really strong and powerful, and I don't have that with it anymore.
Katie wrote an email to the senior associate athletic director, Erin O'Connell, detailing her experiences with Coach Metcalf. She provided me with a copy of the message. O'Connell confirmed that she received it and shared Katie's concerns with others in the department. It wasn't the first time an athlete complained to the university about Metcalf. In 2015, a group of students took their concerns to the athletic director. Subsequently, Metcalf was put on probation for a year. Other runners told me they chose not to go to the university. Remember Amy Liam, who was in a meeting where Coach Metcalf called one of her teammates fat? She says during her last couple years of college, she lived in houses with other track and cross-country runners.
And somebody would always come home crying. So we would sit around and we'd talk about, truthfully, like, how could we get him fired? We would think about all of the things that he's done, and we're like, that has to be a fireable offense.
But Amy says she never told the university about Metcalf's behavior.
I really wanted to run professionally. I always wanted to be an Olympian. Like, it was my lifelong dream. I never wanted to start anything or say anything because I was worried it would ruin my career. I didn't know any other professional runners. I didn't know any agents. I don't know any other coaches. And so I didn't want to ruin the only connection, even though I didn't like my connection. I wish he never was my connection. To make it further in the career that I was looking for, I was worried that I would ruin that whole thing.
This spring, two current student athletes went to the athletic department to discuss Metcalf. The next day, the university announced a mutual separation.
When I found out that Coach Metcalf had resigned, I felt just like relief.
I asked the University of Washington's Carter Henderson what, if anything, the university learned in 2018 that hadn't already been alleged in 2015. Henderson didn't answer that question, but he did say in an email that since 2016, the university has been conducting annual anonymous surveys and exit interviews in all sports to get feedback on important issues. Henderson says from the time those surveys began through May 17, 2018, no allegations of misconduct by Coach Metcalf were reported. But Katie Knight emailed her concerns to the university during that time period, at the end of the 2017 track season. Right as this story was almost ready to go to air, I got an unexpected phone call.
Hello, this is Greg.
Greg Metcalf called me and told me he was willing to talk about what happened from his perspective.
My job as a coach, first and foremost, it is, you know, to take care of every student athlete in our program. And the ultimate goal is to go, you know, be the very best that every single student athlete can be.
I asked Metcalf about the men's only meeting Amy Leah told me about. She says she overheard Metcalf calling one of his athletes.
Things like, you're a fat piece of.
Metcalf told me he doesn't remember the specific incident, but.
I know that I would get fired up. And when we're, you know, a men's only meeting, you know, I would talk to young men, how I, you know, probably I was talked to as an athlete. You know, if I said it, it was, you know, to a kid that I believe could handle it. And, you know, it was intended to have a positive result. You know, the things that I said to young people along the way were with the sole intention of, hey, where are we now? How do we get better? And how can we improve? And what areas can we improve in?
As for calling Lindsay Kirschman a fat lesbian.
I 100% did not say that. I would not say that to another young person about another young person.
Metcalf actually called me back about an hour after our interview to reiterate that he would never use the term lesbian negatively. As far as the meeting about Katie Knight's training logs goes, Metcalf remembers it differently.
You know, I don't remember yelling at her about it, but I remember having a conversation with her about, you know, using a training log that I could read that would allow myself and my assistant to coach her, you know, to the very best of our abilities.
I reached out to the assistant coach who was also at that meeting, but I never heard back. Lindsay Kirschman, the runner who says Metcalf called her a fat lesbian, is a coach herself now, a distance running and strength and conditioning coach at a high school in Colorado. She says the story of Metcalf is much bigger than just one coach, one team, and one university.
Why this story is so important, it's not to just look at one person and point our fingers and be like, wow, you really messed it up in a gossipy way, but it's to highlight the value and the importance of a transformational coach. Like, there are very few types of leaders that have the potential to make such drastic transformational changes as a coach does. The track is just a training ground for the battlefield that is real life. And so I think that's really what he missed out on in a big way. I mean, The amount of talent that went through those doors was phenomenal, and he could have just rocked the world with it if he would have done it right.
This story came to us from reporter Eilish O'Neill in Seattle. On March 6th, 1950, Hall of Famer Dolph Schayes and the NBA's Syracuse Nationals took on St. Lawrence University.
We were a small college team who had an average, decent record against other small college teams.
The story of one of basketball's greatest upsets just ahead on Only a Game.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
I'm Mike Pesca. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the Savannah Bananas will peel back the layers. You knew I was going to slip that in. But enough of baseball team bananas. Onto Only a Game's top banana, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Mike.
Hey. So as questions of abuse cling to the Ohio State wrestling team, now the football team is experiencing its own upheaval. So Zach Smith, a longtime assistant to head coach Urban Meyer, was fired after his history of alleged domestic abuse became public. But then Smith's former wife, Courtney, alleged that the entire coaching staff, including Meyer, knew about this. Charlie, what do you think of the suspension of Urban Meyer?
Well, I think, given what we know, that it's perfectly appropriate. He signed a contract extension in April that requires him to report anything like this on his staff. I would think human decency would require him to report anything like this going on his staff. And I think he's in big trouble, because I think this woman is not going to go away, and she's enormously credible.
All right, well, let's stick in the Big Ten. A less serious story, a prominent coach, Jim Harbaugh, who is the third highest paid man in the NCAA. Urban Meyer is the fourth, by the way. He has some dietary advice. What is Jim Harbaugh recommending?
Not a big chicken fan.
No.
His problem with eating chicken is that he thinks it's a nervous bird. Well, you know, they're going to cut this thing's head off. Of course it's freaking nervous.
That's right.
But apparently he thinks that white meat has somehow affected the human population. This is, of course, madness, and I really think Coach Harbaugh should see somebody about this opinion. Wade Boggs used to eat chicken before every game. Now, it's very hard for me to see that weakened him in any way. The guy's in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Okay, so Art Briles is a former Baylor coach. He was fired after the program mishandled sexual assaults committed by players. Now Briles is the head coach in that football hotbed of
Firenze. Yeah, an American football team in Florence. Guelfi Firenze has hired Briles to be its football coach. But he's very excited to coach football even in Firenze. And let's face facts, would you rather live in Florence or in Waco?
Yeah.
Because that's where he lived before. All things considered, I'd rather coach in Florence, where they don't expect you to do anything except be on the sideline.
Okay. It is reported that Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson will go head-to-head in a $10 million winner-take-all match over Thanksgiving. Now, somewhere, are Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson saying, you know, we are better than these two guys?
Obviously, it's a TV show.
Uh-huh.
And it's Thanksgiving weekend, which is one of the major sports weekends of the year. And here we have two guys who don't need the $10 million. Well, I don't know about Tiger, maybe. Maybe
yeah,
Tiger
well.
Needs the $10 million. But, you know, they're going to play for a big payoff. And the temptation, I'm sure, to string this thing out for drama's sake will be overwhelming. I don't know. I mean, you know, if you want to watch it, watch it. I will not be watching it. I will be watching some football somewhere.
NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, never loath to follow the lead of the NBA, has imitated the NBA yet again. What is he copying?
He wants a cut of the legalized gambling, now that we have legalized sports betting across this great nation of ours. He is applying the fundamental adage of all commissioners, me some too, yes. And, you know, we knew this was coming, by the way. They fought it tooth and nail for 70 years, and as soon as it became legal, they want a piece of it.
So Colin Kaepernick, late of the San Francisco 49ers and the NFL, has been left out again. This time his name was censored from a song on the new Madden NFL 19 soundtrack. Is this more evidence for his collusion lawsuit against the NFL?
Well, Electronic Arts thinks it is because they apologized almost immediately and said it was an unfortunate mistake. His name was left out of a song called Big Bank by YG, but apparently it has a lot of names of football players in it. And Kaepernick's name was conspicuously left out of the recording they use in the game. And somebody caught it.
All right, last on our list, but also last in the National Football League for the last couple of seasons, the Cleveland Browns. They have a new slogan. It might seem like a misspelling, blanketing the stadium or signs, "Welcome to the Hardland of America," but that's Hardland, H-A-R-D-L-A-N-D, and the team is wearing shirts that say hard, and they're saying that acronym stands for Hungry, Accountable, Restless, and Determined. Have the Browns fumbled this one too?
They're the Browns, Mike. You know, this is one of the browniest Browns thing they ever did.
Browning at Max Brown.
We have reached peak Browns, I think, with this slogan. Because, number one, they're going to stink again this year. Mm. They're going to be god-awful. And number two, nobody can make sense out of this.
Yeah, I was thinking of hard, and I came up with a couple of other ones for the Browns. Hardly a respectable defense. How about reaching decency? And hoping ain't really doing.
How about diehard?
Credit to the Browns fans, though. They have parades around their stadium for an 0-16 season.
Yes, but that was embarrassing, too.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he has been joining us on Only a Game each week for 25 years. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Mike.
Remember when the Philadelphia 76ers were terrible? Of course you do. It was 2 years ago, and then just about every season going back to Allen Iverson. So back in, say, 2015, 2016, when the Sixers went 10-72, people would always ask, could a great college team beat the Sixers? Alas, the process did not allow for such hypotheticals. But there was a time when the hypothetical became real. A college squad that really took on an NBA team. In fact, it was the NBA team that would become the 76ers, and an NBA team that, at the time, was actually really good. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
At 2:41 p.m. on a recent Tuesday, St. Lawrence University archives technician Paul Haggett received an inquiry from the athletic department. This sort of thing happens all the time.
They need a picture of so-and-so, or what day did the basketball schedule start, you know, on whatever year. But when this particular question crossed my email, I just sort of totally dismissed it and went, no way, that's ridiculous.
The question, which was sparked by a tip from an Only a Game listener, was whether the St. Lawrence University men's basketball team had played and won a 1950 exhibition game against the NBA's Syracuse Nationals.
So I thought, okay, a bunch of college guys are going to beat a professional basketball team? That just seems preposterous to me. I went, nah, there's no way this is true.
Haggett has worked at St. Lawrence for a decade. At this point, he's not often surprised when it comes to the university's history. Still, he decided he'd better check into it.
So I walked back into our vault where we keep all of our archival records.
He pulled out a box with men's basketball records and found the folder for the 1949-50 season.
And right there on top is a narrative of the last 15 or so minutes of the ball game. I couldn't believe it.
The Syracuse Nationals, winners of the Eastern Division of the National Basketball Association, will be seen here in Canton Monday night, the St. Lawrence student newspaper announced ahead of the March 6, 1950 matchup. Proceeds from the game would go to the Canton Youth Commission, which was raising money for a bus to shuttle local kids to a nearby beach.
So it was a fundraiser, and somebody had the genius idea of bringing in a professional basketball team that was in the throes of pretty darn good season.
This was a powerful team in the infant NBA.
That's sports columnist David Ramsey, who's researched the Syracuse Nationals in the early years of the NBA.
These guys were fiery, nasty basketball players.
In terms of their physicality, the Nationals weren't so different from the rest of the league at the time, but a player they'd recently picked up out of New York University stood out.
Dolph Schayes was a man before his time. Fast, a big guy who didn't just stand under the basket. I think it's inarguable that Dolph Schayes was one of the top 50 players ever.
On the other side, you had St. Lawrence University, which had just finished its season with a 13-5 record against other small colleges. And while the Nationals had multiple players over 6'6", St. Lawrence's tallest player stood at 6'3".
Do you remember what it was like leading up to that game against Syracuse? Did you guys talk about it at all, or were you excited?
I don't want to downplay it, but we didn't really play it up before the game.
That's 90-year-old Warren Elmsley. I recently visited him and Carol Elmsley, his wife of 62 years in Connecticut.
We were not, let's say we were not awed by them.
I think if you look at the team photos...
That's St. Lawrence Archives technician Paul Haggett again.
You can tell that there are a couple of guys there that have a little life experience behind them that a typical collegiate basketball player today wouldn't. They have a more mature look.
We had several veterans on the basketball team.
Warren Elmsley joined the Navy at 17 years old, just as World War II was coming to an end.
Bill O'Rourke had been in the Marines.
He fought in the South Pacific, Guadalcanal, other pretty bad places.
This is O'Rourke's son, Bill O'Rourke Jr.
There's hand-to-hand combat. We weren't only fighting the enemy, but fighting, you know, he got malaria there, he got jaundice, he got a skin condition called jungle rot. He was right in the middle of it.
Another starter for St. Lawrence had also served in the Pacific as a radio man.
The war veterans on the team were not going to be intimidated by playing a pro team.
When the Syracuse Nationals came to town, Bill O'Rourke, St. Lawrence's leading scorer, was 26 years old, making him 5 years older than Syracuse star Dolph Schayes. The game was to be played at Brewer Fieldhouse.
It was, even then, in 1950, it was old.
Elmsley says the gym was so small that you had to be careful of crashing into the wall after driving for a layup. The field house only seated a few hundred, and fans sat in a ring of bleachers a level above the court.
And of course, the basketball season's in the middle of winter. Lots of snow, lots of ice. So the story goes that the students would take great delight in sitting over top of the visiting bench and let their wet shoes drip on the visiting team.
This is the hostile environment the Syracuse Nationals faced on that Monday night in 1950. 450 fans packed Brewer Fieldhouse, though it may have been 451, depending on whether Bill O'Rourke Jr. made it into the official attendance.
I was only about 3 months short of turning three, so I sat with my mom the entire game, probably sat in her lap for a lot of it, but I was there.
According to newspaper accounts, it wasn't hard to tell early on which team had the pros.
The Nationals staged a smooth exhibition of court wizardry.
I remember my father said that they were kind of showing off and not really taking it seriously.
That's Steve Lawrence, whose father Roger also started for St. Lawrence.
The Nationals made little effort to drive under the hoop for layups and were content to score on medium-distance pop shots or hooks from the sides. Although St. Lawrence had numerous easy opportunities to score, they appeared to be nervous and were missing badly.
At halftime, the Nationals led 40-29. But in the second half, St. Lawrence adjusted its strategy. They stopped making substitutions, instead sticking with their starting five.
After we got going, we were kind of surprised that it was a close game. Now, I'm not sure how hard Syracuse played, but we figured, hey, we can beat these guys.
St. Lawrence started chipping away at the Syracuse lead, and with 9 minutes to go, they tied the score at 55.
From there on, the affair ceased to be an exhibition and became a legitimate basketball game.
Steve Lawrence says his father could feel the difference when the Nationals started to take the game more seriously.
My father said he remembered going up for a layup one time and some guy came down and really crashed down on him about, you know, just to prevent him from doing it. And he says, oh my God, I've never been hit so hard in my life.
But with less than 2 minutes to go, the score was still tied. Warren Elmsley got to the foul line and sank two free throws to give St. Lawrence the lead, but Syracuse answered with a basket to even the score at 67. It was St. Lawrence ball with less than a minute to go.
And my dad said one of his teammates took a shot, missed. And my dad said he got an offensive rebound, up faked one of the Syracuse players, and then put in the winning basket.
The final score, St. Lawrence University 69, the NBA's Syracuse Nationals 67.
I think everybody was sort of dumbstruck that we won, you know, and we were. I mean, come on now, this is one of the top professional teams in the country, and we won.
Elmsley finished with a game-high 18 points, eight more than Dolph Shays. It was Elmsley's best game of the season.
I guess I just had a lucky game. No, I'm not trying to downplay that.
So tell me about what happened after the game, because I'm imagining, you know, huge parties, parade through town.
No, not at all. I know I didn't do anything. I don't think it was a school night. I mean, you know, we had classes the next day.
That was Warren Elmsley's last game for St. Lawrence. Aside from playing in some adult rec leagues, it was also the end of his basketball career. He went on to work in the banking industry. As for Bill O'Rourke Sr., St. Lawrence's top player,
he said that Syracuse offered him a tryout because they liked what they saw, and my dad did not accept the tryout because he already had a firm offer to teach ninth grade social studies and coach varsity basketball. You know, it was a solid offer, and he had my mom and me to support. I think he could have played in the NBA. I'm not just saying this. I'm being very objective here.
The Nationals managed okay without him. About a month after losing to St. Lawrence, they reached the NBA Finals, falling to the Minneapolis Lakers 4-2. A few years later, Dolph Shays led the Nationals to an NBA title. O'Rourke coached the varsity team at Webster High School in New York for 28 years. When he retired, his son took over the job for another 35 seasons.
So somebody named Bill O'Rourke coached the varsity in Webster for 63 straight years.
Bill O'Rourke Sr. died in 2006. Steve Lawrence's father, Roger Lawrence, passed away in 2001. But throughout his life, Roger Lawrence loved telling the story about the time he and his college teammates beat the Syracuse Nationals.
It was one of the highlights of his life. Every time he talked about it, you can see the look in his eyes. You know, my sisters and I probably heard the stories about 100 times. We would always let my father finish the story because it made him so happy.
As for Warren Elmsley, he didn't talk about the game much. His own children hadn't even heard the story.
We all felt good about it, of course, but I don't know, what were we going to do? Go around with a sign on that says we played the national basketball?
Yeah.
So it just kind of came and went, and that was it.
But now that Paul Haggett and the rest of the folks at the St. Lawrence University archives are onto the story, Elmsley won't have to worry about spreading the word himself. The 70th anniversary is coming up. Maybe it's not too late for a parade.
That story from Martin Kessler, thanks to St. Lawrence University for opening up their archives, and to listener Phil Morey for sending us the tip that sparked this whole thing. If you've got an idea for only a game, obviously we may use it. Please email us at oag@wbur.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, who combined to battle the 1950 Tri-City Blackhawks to a draw in a game of horse. We had help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given, who points out that Gene Burse of the 1950 Tri-City Blackhawks is currently 91 years old. Our final word comes from former St. Lawrence University basketball player Warren Elmsley. Apparently, losing to a bunch of college guys wasn't the end of the Syracuse Nationals' troubles.
They had a stay in the hotel in Canton, which was pretty bad.
I imagine the Yelp reviews were scathing. I'm Mike Pesca. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.